I'm your host for BUFO Paranormal and UFO Radio with our guest tonight, Dr. Michael Sala. We will be discussing some of Dr. Sala's latest projects. One of special interest to me is the Dulles Report concerning the UFO/government underground facility in New Mexico. Hello, Dr. Sala, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for being here. We appreciate it. There's so many of us that are interested in your work. I'm a regular subscriber to your paper that you put out, your reports. That's exopolitics.org, right?
That's right.
Yeah. You have some interesting things that you put out all the time, and I always look forward to receiving them in my email. But I understand that you've been investigating Benowitz's claims regarding massive human rights abuses by ETs in Dulles.
That's correct, yes. I thought he was a fascinating case of someone who had a very technical background and who was able to get some hard evidence on what was the activities concerning UFOs, ETs at an underground location at Dulles there. So that was an interesting case for me to explore. And so when I did the research, I found that there was a lot of other references to Dulles there and what happened there. So that's how the report grew.
Now, have you ever been there?
No, not yet. But I plan to make a visit there at some point.
We've been there twice.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. It's a real interesting place. It's very poverty stricken in that area. That's where the Chiricahua Indians are.
Right.
And very poor. Apparently, they use from, you know, what some of the locals in that area said, they use the people of the town, the Indians, various people, to spy, you know, for any, visitors or tourists that might appear on the land, and then they report them. You know, so, it's very well watched.
Yes, poverty certainly does make it easy to manipulate people.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like a lot of them are on government fundings, and because of the government fundings, they have to report the various things that go on there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're ever in the town, it's very small, and like I said, very poverty stricken, but sitting right in the middle of that little tiny town is a great big hotel, you know, with a casino. And it isn't a tourist area whatsoever. So who's the, what's the hotel for? You know, it's like a five-star hotel.
Hmm.
I mean, so what guests are appearing there? You know, it can't be the Indians, you know, or the locals because they can't afford it. And it definitely isn't tourists because they discourage anyone, you know, going through the area,
mm-hmm.
you know, for staying.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll definitely have to have a look when I get down there.
Yeah, yeah. I may have some pictures, and I'll send them to you if I can come across them again.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
But we actually stopped at the hotel and went inside because they have like a little gift store there too. But and we checked out the casino. Well, we just kind of looked in real fast, and there was nobody in the casino. And as far as the gift store, I went inside there, and no one even came in there to wait on me. You know, they didn't seem too thrilled to even have us there. We didn't feel very welcome at all in that hotel.
So it sounds like definitely putting out some unwelcome vibrations for you.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. So we assume that what they're doing is having this hotel for visitors coming, you know, to that facility.
Mm.
You know, someone that doesn't have the clearance, you know, to be able to actually go down into some of the housing areas. That's
right.
in the underground facility.
Mm.
Yeah. But so anyhow, tell me what you heard. What's all going on with your investigation there and with what you found out on Benowitz?
Well, I mean, Benowitz himself is a fascinating character because, as you know, I mean, he was someone that was very prominent in exposing the Dulles base back in the early 80s, and the evidence he put together was pretty persuasive that something definitely was going on in the area. And because of his, he's really a brilliant electronics specialist. I mean, someone who has 4 patents, had his own electronics business, and someone who really was able to definitely make a case that the evidence he had put together was pointing to something going on down there. I mean, he wasn't someone who was going to be put off by people or specialists in the various branches or in the Air Force saying that he wasn't reading the evidence correctly. I mean, he knew what he was seeing, and he really did make a strong case, and he got together a lot of support for what he was recording. And then as it emerged, as you probably know, that the Air Force Office of Special Investigations basically put together a disinformation campaign to try to discredit Benowitz. And by and large, that was pretty successful. By the end of the 80s, most reputable UFO researchers thought that, you know, even though Benowitz did get some pretty hard evidence that something was going on at Dulce, that most of Benowitz's views were basically a product of disinformation. And so all of the stories about the abductees being taken and being violated in various ways, and holding bats and storage of humans and hybrid experiments, that all of that was disinformation that was fed to Benowitz. That was basically the kind of perception that grew around him. And so most people just thought, well, it was just a sad opportunity in terms of what benefit Benowitz had and his knowledge.
But so, you don't believe that?
Well, not based on the subsequent evidence. I mean, then after Benowitz pretty well disappears from the scene, you have a kind of steady stream of whistleblowers coming forward, talking about various aspects of the Dulce case. One who did come forward, Thomas Costello,
yeah,
who's a fairly kind of mysterious figure because he wasn't someone that could be easily found and interviewed and vouched for, but nevertheless a few UFO researchers did find him. Bill Hamilton, I believe, actually got to interview him, or someone that Bill Hamilton knows interviewed him directly. So there's that evidence that, well, you know, Thomas Costello is a real live person who claimed to actually have worked in the Dulce facility and saw what was happening down there. And so he confirmed a lot of the stories about there being places where there were hybrid experiments going on, humans, civilians abducted and held against their will for an extended period of time, humans also being placed in cold storage vats, cold storage tubes, and also human body parts seen in some of the vats. So, I mean, those are stories that Costello was able to confirm. And he wasn't the only one, but certainly he was someone that did make a case that, based on his long experience there and the physical evidence that he smuggled out, that Dulce was a place where really gross human rights violations were occurring.
There's also Phil Schneider, right?
Well, he's someone that I think it really does provide very credible evidence that Dulce is an underground facility that houses both military personnel and an ET civilization or ET race that has been there for many, many centuries. Schneider, as you all know, gave a series of lectures from 94 to 95, and then was found dead in his apartment in January of 96.
Right, 7 months prior to, it was 7 months after his last lecture, right?
That's right, yes, after that big lecture at MUFON, at the MUFON conference. But Schneider talked about an encounter or a confrontation, a military confrontation, where he was with a group of Delta Force and other military personnel, and they went down a prepared tunnel, and that they found the an ancient race of the Tall Greys, and that there was a firefight, and he was involved in that.
And that was in 79.
And that was in 79. And so there's confirmation that there was a firefight there in 79, something that Costello himself also talked about. And so that was pretty powerful evidence that, well, here is someone who certainly had the credentials, the knowledge, and he also referred to, Schneider referred to him playing a role in building the Dulce base, so someone who actually was aware of that underground facility. And here he's saying he's involved in a firefight at Dulce with an ancient race of the Tall Greys.
Now, I'm going to quote Bill Schneider here. He says, 66 Secret Service agents, FBI, Black Beret, and the like died in that firefight. I was there.
That's correct. So it was certainly indicating that there was a pretty intense dispute happening there. I don't think Schneider was made or given all the information. I mean, when one reads his interview, you know, the story as he puts it is that, well, they dug this this shaft into the countryside near the Dulce base.
Right.
And they suddenly find, and he explained it as though they were building an extension to
right.
the existing facility.
And yeah, it was by accident they came on to them, right?
Exactly. So it seems that he wasn't told, you know, what the real reason was, and I think that there was more to it. Costello described the reason for the for the firefight as being because the military thought that the security guards on the site and the ETs were collaborating to basically get the humans liberated. So it seemed as though there was, you know, something deeper as to why the firefight happened, rather than an accidental discovery, as Schneider describes it.
Well, after the firefight in 1979, that ended everything as far as us trying to rescue anyone that might be down there?
Well, it seemed that it put a stop to things for a couple of years, but then everything resumed again later.
Oh, it did?
Yes. Whatever operations they had down there just resumed after they were able to resolve the dispute they had. And that comes from John Lear.
Uh-huh.
John Lear talked about that. Also, another person, another whistleblower, interestingly, is Bob Lazar, who worked out at
Area 51.
NS4. Yeah. He talked about the firefight in 79 as well. He didn't actually mention Dulce, but he talked about a briefing document that he had to go through before he started to work at Groom Lake. And he said that, well, this briefing document that was pretty thick referred to a firefight in 1979 between military forces and an ET race. So again, you have another whistleblower basically referring to that referring to a 1979 firefight. And so, you know, there's partial confirmation that, well, something happened at Dulce in 1979.
Well, from what I understand, there's close to 129 deep underground military bases in the United States, and that we have close to $125 trillion spent a year in these black budgets. And where are they coming from? Where is this money coming from?
That's a really good question. The money, according to Phil Schneider, that is used to fund these bases and these black projects all around the country and around the planet. He gives the estimate of $1.25 trillion a year.
Yeah.
Now, another source for that, the size of the black budget, is Catherine Fitz, who was an assistant secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and she found that that HUD was basically being used as a source for illegal funding.
HUD?
HUD, that's right.
Really?
Yes. She has a website. It's solari.com, S-O-L-A-R-I.com, and she has a few online articles talking about how HUD and the Pentagon are used for siphoning massive amounts of federal taxes into black projects. And her estimates are that $1.1 trillion every year goes into these black projects. So, you know, if you think of the Pentagon budget as for this year it's $380 billion, well, $1.1 trillion is almost three times as much as that.
Yeah.
So that's a tremendous amount of money that's getting the black budget. And now, so you can get an idea of exactly what it is that's funding the black operations, like all of these underground tunnels and the various reverse engineering projects that are underway at places like Dulce and elsewhere.
And what do you think the purpose of this these underground tunnels? What are they doing there?
Well, I think there are a number of things happening. One is that they basically stumbled onto an underground transportation system that existed from earlier civilizations, that they found something, and they basically used what was there to extend it with their own technology.
Now, they, speaking as U.S. government, governments?
The U.S. government, the various military services that began to work with the ET presence.
Well, now, how did the ET come in?
Well, the exact date for when the U.S. government began to form agreements with the ETs varies. Some say it was as early as 1933 under Roosevelt, but most sources point to 1954 when there was a treaty signed between an ET race from, some say it was from Zeta Reticulum, others say it was from Rigel and Orion, but essentially the short greys that most people are familiar with, that there was a treaty signed in 1954, and from that time the government began to work with ETs at joint facilities. The government provided the facility, the space, or get permission for the facility and for the greys to be present there, and in exchange the greys provided technology that they would assist the U.S. military services in reverse engineering.
Now, why hasn't the government told us about ET?
Well, I think they basically were trying to work out, firstly, what the ETs were doing, what they wanted, before they developed the program for releasing it to the public. I think that they realized back in 54 that the ETs were here for some time and had been abducting civilians and been performing genetic experiments on them. And basically, I think that they saw the treaty as a means for them to be able to do a number of things. One, get technology from the ETs. Two, find out exactly what the ETs were doing with the abducted civilians. So they basically, in the treaty, it appears that they required that the greys provide information on all abducted civilians, that they not harm the civilians in any way, and that they merely do what it is that they were doing, but just let the U.S. authorities know what it was that they were doing.
Yeah, but when you consider Dulce, or Dulce, people call it different names here, or pronounce it different ways, when you consider Dulce, then you got a problem, because the government, you said that there's vats of humans, and there's experiments going on, so if... then, and the government knows about this, then aren't they? They're participating in hurting their own kind. It's almost like they're turning against their own people here.
I think that they started off with the idea, what might have appeared to be a good intention of just monitoring the greys in terms of what the greys were doing. But I think that they then began to do their own mind control and their own genetic experiments. I mean, as you know, with Project Paperclip, a lot of the Nazi scientists that had been working on mind control methods had come over to the US, and so these Nazi scientists began to pioneer various technologies and methods for mind control. And so what the military authorities did was to basically try to upgrade or improve their mind control methods based on what they were seeing the Greys doing, because the Greys apparently were able to abduct individuals, perform whatever genetic experiments that they wanted, and then release these individuals into the general population again without the individuals having any memory of what had happened.
Yeah.
And plus they had implants, which meant that the Greys could monitor these individuals. And so the military people probably thought, well, you know, is this a potential fifth column? Exactly what are the Greys doing? So they basically, I think, did what many would assume would be a kind of rational policy, which is, well, let's try and duplicate what the Greys are doing. So they went and did their own experiment.
So the end justifies the means, as far as the government's concerned.
Yes, I don't think they have any moral qualms about abducting civilians, exposing them to various genetic and mind control technologies, because they believed that, well, the Greys were doing it, so they had to understand what the Greys were doing it. And if the Greys weren't doing it, well, the Soviets were certainly doing it, so they had to understand what the Soviets were doing. So I think based on that kind of thinking, that they had no moral qualms about performing a whole range of experiments that...
So if they're that deep into this, chances are then they never will come clean about the aliens being here on Earth, because otherwise it would get out of what they were doing as well.
Well, I think there are different factions within the military and within the government in terms of those who run the ET operations. Some are pretty much into the programs themselves, and they just see them as an opportunity to try and learn new techniques and technologies, and they have no moral qualms. And they basically do abuse any civilians who do unhappily get involved in these things or abducted into these projects. But I think there are other factions who are much more progressive and wanting genuinely to get the information out about the ET presence and wanting to acclimate the general population for disclosure of the ET presence. And I think somehow that the firefight in 1979 may have delayed things in terms of the release of or disclosing the ET presence, because it happened 2 years after the Spielberg movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind was released.
Yeah.
Which meant, if one looks at the timing, that, well, if Spielberg really did produce Close Encounters as something that would prepare the population for disclosure, well, then you have 2 years after that, you have a firefight at Dulcet over something that we're still not quite clear, but presumably it was a pretty profound disagreement over exactly what was happening down there. And so I assume that what happened was that the government probably decided that the Greys were doing things that they didn't like, which meant that disclosure was not something that they were going to do in the meantime. And so they basically have waited, and I guess we're still waiting 20 odd years afterwards.
Yeah. Manitowoc, I hear, is still going strong too.
Yes, apparently they closed the surface areas at Manitowoc, but deep underground, the facility is operating, and those people who have been working at Manitowoc, Preston Nichols, Al Bilak, Stuart Swordlow, they report that, yes, Manitowoc is going.
Yeah, that's, it's supposed to be a national park there? or a state, federal, state park, something. And,
yeah.
But you're not allowed to go in. There's no trespassing signs all over.
Yes, apparently at one point one could go in there, but it looked as though they sealed off the area. You know, presumably they gave the reason that, well, because this was an old facility and it was kind of crumbling, that people were endangered by going there. But it did look as though that the surface entrances and so forth had been cemented, and so there was no entrance into the underground facility through the national park area and what was the old base, Air Force base there.
Yeah. Over at Dulles, I hear there's activity going on about 2 miles outside the actual town on a mesa. You hear anything about that?
The Archiluca Mesa, that's where Benowitz took a lot of his photos and flew his plane and he got a lot of his electronic, well, some of that electronic information emanated from the Dulce Mesa there, from the Archiluca Mesa.
Yeah, we drove right by there. Didn't know it until after we got back, and then it's like, darn, I missed it. You
right.
know. But did you know, isn't that right on the Continental Divide?
That I'm not sure of. I do know that there's a vast underground cavern system there, which suggests that there probably has been a lot of underground activity there for many, many centuries.
There's another place not far from there that has an underground facility, and that's called Pie Town. Just a little tiny town, and if you blinked your eyes, you'd go through it and
okay,
miss it.
Okay.
And,
heard of that one.
Yeah, and there's an underground facility there too, and it's right on the Continental Divide. And I had noticed that when I was looking at the maps of where some of these underground facilities were, it seemed to me like there was a lot of them lying over top, on top of that Continental Divide area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, possibly related to any kind of, well, if there would be caverns created by seismic movements, shifting of the continental plates, well, that might be where you could expect to find some natural cavern system which would allow a base, an extensive underground base to be built.
Yeah. Well, you said that this was an ancient civilization underground that had its own travel systems going?
Yes. Schneider talked about the tall greys as being an ancient race, having been there for many, many centuries. And he also mentioned that that a lot of the tunnels were there that they used for building the underground rail had been used before. So Schneider himself referred to that.
I think that somebody came across something like that over in the Grand Canyon area too, didn't they? A facility, and they had some sort of a railway system set up.
I wouldn't be surprised, because Schneider did talk about that underground rail system as being all around the country, and Richard Souter in his book also talked about that underground rail system.
Now, so these greys pre-existed us?
Well, exactly when they appeared on the planet, I mean, as you probably know, or your listeners know, I mean, many people refer to an ancient ET race, a reptilian race that even predated the human presence on the planet. And presumably that's where a lot of the difficulty comes from, that if you had an ancient, say, reptilian race that lived on the surface of the planet at some time and who were then forced to go underground, and then you had the human presence presumably being seeded by humanoid ET races, well, then you would probably have a kind of very interesting conflict between, you know, the humans that were now seated on the surface of the planet ET races, humanoid ET races that seeded them and protected the humans, and an ancient reptilian race that figures in the equation as having been there many, many thousands of years before the human presence, and also played a role in the genetic engineering of the humans.
The Hopi Indians have a lot of legends on this.
Right.
That they came from underground and was forced onto the surface because of the reptilians. You know, and that there's supposed to be different entrances in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Montezuma Well in Arizona is one of the entrances of where they one of their exits, I should say, where the Indians that came out. Mm-hmm. And they said another place was over there at Dulles.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the Indians would have a lot of information about that.
Unfortunately, they don't tell many people either, you know. They know more than they tell, let's say that.
Right.
But of course they're trying to protect their race as well, because who knows what's going to happen with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important that we all know where these underground tunnel systems are, though.
Yes, I think it's very important because, I mean, it's part of the cleansing process, I mean, and the healing process, because these things have been occurring for many, many centuries. I certainly don't think this is the only time that humans have been abused in these underground facilities by ET races. I think what's unique is that while now humans are doing it because they've been learning from the ET races that have been doing it for so long. And now we have clandestine military operations who are using these techniques so that they can exercise mind control and create genetic hybrids using abducted civilians. So that's new, but certainly the ancient ET presence is probably the most disturbing for people, because I mean it suggests that while they've been doing this for many thousands of years, and so how do we as a race deal with the truth that while, you know, once the ET presence is acknowledged, that while it's not just a kind of happy story of while these visitors coming from the stars and giving us all this wonderful technology, it's also acknowledging that while for thousands of years we've had these underground based extraterrestrials who have been harvesting humans for purposes that we would find to be, you know, quite horrendous, and we have to deal with that and kind of heal whatever bitterness or anger that we have as a kind of collective presence on the planet.
It seems like we always knew of them until a certain area, like what we call the Dark Ages. And then after the Dark Ages, and we were allowed to start thinking and reading again for, you know, all of a sudden we started developing that sense of awareness again.
Mm. That's very interesting, because one finds that when you look at some of the ancient historians, that there was a period in time when the gods, as they called the ETs, were physically present, I mean physically out in the open. One looks at the ancient Egyptian historian Manetho, and he talks about the time before the human dynasties, before the human pharaohs, where the gods ruled directly, and so you have similar references in the Book of Enoch.
Mm-hmm.
Also in the Sumerian records of the Anunnakim, or the Nephilim, as they're called in the Book of Enoch.
Mm-hmm.
Again, these gods or ETs were out in the open. Everyone could see them. And then, strangely, for reasons that aren't clear, they suddenly disappeared, that they were no longer out in the open. And now you have human kings. And these human kings were, you know, the stories or the legends were that they were placed there by the gods or by the ETs to have control over humans. So it's suggesting that they were being controlled, but the ETs disappear from the scene. So I think that's a very significant event.
Yeah. It's like our memory has been purposely erased on, or tried to be erased on, this culture of aliens. the monuments, the inscriptions, old texts, everything that they could find, have been taken from the public, you know, and hidden or placed someplace, you know, like, well, look at the Vatican. From what I understand, the Vatican has a huge library of books, you know, on the alien existence. But we're not allowed to, very few people are allowed to see these books.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's very much like the childhood entering into, the child entering into early adulthood or into that period of maturity where, like in the Indian tradition and many other primitive traditions, when the child, typically the male, reaches a certain age, around the 12-year age, they're let loose. They're let loose from the community and they have to fend for themselves for a time. And so the child will wander and, you know, they're taught what to do, but essentially they're on their own. And I think in a way that is kind of like what the ETs did with humanity as a species. You know, we have for the last few thousand years kind of been let loose. You know, we go and do things on our own. And, you know, we either survive and prosper or we basically fail and self-destruct as a species. So I think in the present area, what we've demonstrated is that we've survived, that we've gone through that period of being kind of cut loose and had to fend for ourselves out in this kind of, on the planet Earth itself. And now we've reached the point where, we reach another critical juncture. Do we, as a mature species, self-destruct because we've developed the technology, for example, atomic weaponry, that we can destroy ourselves, or do we move forward into maturity where we now become fully fledged citizens or stewards of the Earth, and that's when the ET presence is most likely going to again pop out into the open, and then things will get interesting.
Yeah. Now, there was an ancient nuclear war, atomic war, right?
That's right, yes. People have referred to that. Zechariah Sitchin actually had one of his Earth Chronicles books. He talked about this ancient conflict between the different factions of the Anunnaki, and that... and he talked about that having occurred in parts of Mesopotamia, in southern parts of present-day Iraq. Interestingly, that would help explain why Abraham left the Sumerian city of Ur and had to flee with his family into Palestine, all of those areas that the ancient Israelites occupied. So you have a possible explanation for why you did have this mass movement of people.
And what was that? And what for what reason was it?
Because there was a nuclear war.
Okay.
Between different factions of the Anunnaki.
Now it was within the same culture of the Anunnaki.
He talked. Sitchin talked about the different factions. The two main factions, one led by Enki, the ET,
mm-hmm.
Enki, and the other by Enlil, and they had very different approaches to how to manage the human.
Now, do you also see that in the story of Moses in the Exodus?
That's interesting. When you look at the story of Exodus, you have that fleeing from Egypt. Now
it seemed like there was a possibility there was two opposing gods. You know, one that the Egyptians followed and the other that Moses chose.
Yes. Emmanuel Velikovsky, he believed that the fleeing of Moses from Egypt was also accompanied by some tremendous earth changes, cataclysmic changes, and that, you know, that the Old Testament kind of doesn't really kind of give a full picture of what happened. But his view was that there was some devastating natural events. So that might have been some evidence of a conflict between the different factions, and I do know that there are parts of the Sinai Peninsula where apparently there have been evidence of radioactive material that dates from millennia back that would possibly be evidence of another nuclear confrontation that may have been associated with Moses departing from Egypt.
Now, in your reports, didn't you write something on Iraq that there are certain artifacts that have been found that maybe the United States is interested in getting? Or am I getting...
Yes, definitely. I think that is really the true motivation for why the U.S. was in such a hurry to get into Iraq, because, you know, when one looks at it, at what led to the U.S. intervention and looks at the international conflict that existed between the U.S., France, Germany, Russia, it really is puzzling as to why the U.S. was in such a hurry to get in there and why they didn't wait to get the international consensus they needed, because without that consensus, what you were going to have was precisely what we have now, which is the U.S. is in there, basically struggling to hold things together, and the international community, by and large, saying, "Well, you know, you went in there on your own; you'll have to shoulder the burden on your own." And so, the U.S. is now having had to pay an enormous cost in terms of the money to reconstruct Iraq, and also the toll in terms of soldiers being killed every couple of days is starting to play a very heavy burden on the administration. So, I believe that that diplomatic background, based on the evidence that Sitchin provided of an ancient race in southern Iraq, I believe gives us the reason for why the U.S. went in there, which is that they wanted the technology that was left behind,
yeah,
because that technology is more advanced than they were able to get from the grave.
Yeah, it seems like there's something there. And I just don't buy I know that they were looking at the oil, but of course that would be to help pay for their venture there, but it just seems to me like there's something there that Bush wants awfully bad.
That's right, and when one looks at things like the sacking of the Baghdad Museum, and because the thing about the Baghdad Museum was that was where all of this Sumerian cuneiform texts were housed. Well, not all of them, but certainly a large number of them were housed there, as well as other places in Iraq. Now, these cuneiform texts had a lot of information about the Anunnaki. Now, that information, some of that information may have given the necessary instructions for how to operate such technologies as Stargate.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
So for Stargate, requires a certain amount of information, certain codes for how you activate these things and how you can travel to different places. Well, it would have been in those texts. Now, if those texts are just sitting there in some museum without being translated and without those translations getting to the right people, it meant that, well, if the U.S. did discover Stargate elsewhere in the planet, well, they wouldn't have known how to use them because they didn't have any translations. And so they had to get those translations. And so the Baghdad Museum was one place where they could get that information. And so one of the first places that was looted was the Baghdad Museum. And the interesting thing about it was that it was looted in a way that suggested that there was a method to it, that professionals were running the show.
That they were looking for something
That's
specific.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah.
And a professor from the Oriental Museum from Chicago, a professor Gibson, Mark Gibson, who's one of the world's foremost experts on Iraq, he looked at what happened there, and he concluded that, in his view, that certainly the sacking of the museum was done in a very organized way, suggesting that an outside organization was involved in doing that. So, you know, there again is a point of that, well, someone wanted what was in that museum pretty badly.
And then there could possibly be underground civilizations there too.
Well, that's the other thing. I think that the presence of underground civilizations is something that we really haven't been that aware of. But what I'm seeing now is that more and more evidence is coming forward that rather than ET being a phenomenon that is either up in the sky or underwater, but it also has a lot to do with underground civilizations, that the ET races may have connections with earlier humans that had to relocate under the ground to build civilizations. People talk about ancient Lemuria and ancient Atlantis as being places where they reached a level of civilization that allowed them, when the Earth went through some cataclysmic geological changes, to relocate under the ground.
Right.
And then you have extraterrestrial races, the reptilian race, tall greys, and any other race that are also presumably based underground. And so it wouldn't be too hard to imagine that, well, you have the same phenomenon in Iraq, because the ETs were based in Iraq for many centuries, and so they presumably had something like that there as well. And Saddam Hussein and his people probably discovered this, and they're probably hiding down there now.
Yeah. Now, isn't that in the general area of where the Nazis got their ET information?
Well, the interesting thing about the Nazis was that very early on, Hitler and other key Nazis with him were fascinated by the occult as a means of getting information. I mean, they were pretty smart people.